McFarland, Mr. Kahn.
May it please the court, I'm here today on behalf of the defendants, who are also the appellants. And our appeal today can really be summed up in just two sentences. In March of 1993, this comic book, which is the principal comic book in the case, Spawn Issue 9, was published with a copyright notice that identified Todd McFarland Productions as the sole copyright owner.
Yeah, look, I'm afraid you have a terrible confusion about copyright notice. It isn't the purpose of copyright notice is to warn off copiers. It's not to start statutes of limitations running. Suppose you wrote an article for a magazine. The only copyright notice that would appear on the magazine would be the publisher's copyright notice. But that wouldn't mean that the authors of the articles published in the magazine had lost their copyright, right?
Sure, Your Honor. I agree.
Well, it's the same thing here. Who knows how many people have copyrights in Image 9, right? I mean, there's an advertisement at the back for something by Jeff Darrow and Deathblow. And there's this Image fan art, and there's this thing about the spawning ground, Westlake Village. We don't have any idea. I mean, these are actually letters written by people. They have copyright in these letters. McFarland does not have copyright in these letters by virtue of his having put a copyright notice on the magazine,
Your Honor,
right?
I completely agree.
Right, okay.
I completely agree. In fact, that's why this copyright notice is limited only to the Spawn story in this comic book. There are lots of other things in the comic book. And, Your Honor, I'm not suggesting that a copyright notice deprives anyone of their right. As the court knows, and as Your Honor knows, in cases you've written, the issue when a statute of limitations begins to run in a copyright notice, in a copyright case, is when the plaintiff is on inquiry notice. And
you've misinterpreted your own notice. The notice says Spawn and its logo are trademark and copyright. Now, Spawn, that's a reference to this thing, this compilation, this magazine. This has been copyrighted by McFarland, but it contains other work, including letters from people and Guyman's work, and that notice doesn't say anything about the persistence of copyright of the actual authors.
Your Honor, I respectfully do not agree. The case law out there on co-ownerships of copyrights.
It's not an issue of co-ownership. Look at the New York Times. There's copyright New York Times. But in the New York Times, there's copyrighted material probably owned by hundreds of people, advertisers, letter writers, freelance authors, and so on. People are not employed by the Times. Gaiman isn't employed, not work for hire.
Correct.
It means anything he contributed that's copyrightable was his. And he could look at this notice until he went blind, and there would be absolutely no reason for him to think that his copyright was being challenged.
Well, Your Honor, I don't agree in that, only because I believe this copyright notice is actually limited to the Spawn story. But
well,
we don't need...
It's limited to something called Spawn, this compilation. Just the New York Times is limited to... New York, you look in the front page and you see this is some little magazine called Spawn, and it's copyrighted. But that doesn't mean that the copyright, that the copyright noticer is the owner of all the intellectual property inside it.
No, but the question is whether it should give anyone who believes that he's supposed to own a copyright interest any sort of notice he's not mentioned in it. But we can move ahead. We can go beyond the copyright notices to the second undisputed fact in this case, which shows that this case should not have been allowed to go to the jury, which is the actions of Mr. Gaiman.
Forgive me, but before you do that, I do have a question. Are you essentially arguing that a copyright notice as a matter of law begins the running of the statute of limitations and that the conduct of a defendant is irrelevant, except insofar as it might or could constitute equitable estoppel? Is that your argument?
No, my argument is that a copyright claim could accrue for a co-owner under the Zuhl case and under the Netzer case and others when there's a copyright notice that asserts sole ownership in a copyright.
But it doesn't assert sole ownership.
Your Honor, I was simply
answering. Look at your own reply brief. On page 18, you say, the copyright in a comic book, as in any work of fiction, does not necessarily cover the component parts of the work. Precisely. So when Gaiman looks at your copyright notice, McFarlane copyright, he has no reason to think that that's an assertion of ownership of his copyrightable contribution to the magazine. That's just that's fundamental.
You create something completely out
of whole cloth, no basis for this sort of use of a copyright notice. I mean, this would cause chaos because people, when they write things and it's copyrighted because they're making a contribution to a anthology, a magazine, a this or that, whatever, they don't worry about what the copyright notice says. That's for copiers. That's to warn off copiers. That's not to subtract their copyright.
Well, Your Honor, let's look at the second key undisputed fact, which is the action Mr. Gaiman took in early 1997. And the background is he'd been trying for about a year to get a written agreement governing his rights from the defendants. He received a fax proposal on February 18th of 1997, approximately 5 years before he filed the suit. He describes that proposal as seriously weird, and he goes out and he turns the matter over to his entertainment lawyer, who sends a demand letter.
Nothing is more common, especially, of course, we have an oral contract, than to have authors fussing with publishers over, you know, what they're supposed to get. And the premise of those disputes is that because the author has a copyright, he has an entitlement to something. And then they argue about, you know, what. And of course, it's a big thing in Hollywood where they're always arguing about, you know, whether the studio has treated the actors and so on right. But look, you gave Gaiman royalties on toys. Now, there's no way in the world in which the oral contract could be construed as giving him a contractual claim to royalties on toys. The only basis for such a claim would be that he has a copyright, the toys are derivative works, he has a copyright entitlement to those royalties. So when you give him royalties and you tell him he's getting royalties on toys, you're acknowledging that he's a copyright owner because there isn't any other basis for giving him those royalties.
Actually, in this case, there is, Your Honor, because the alleged agreement is, back in 1982, I will treat you as well as you were treated by DC Comics. DC Comics had what are called character equity agreements in which they would pay their writers for certain characters that the writers were granted under the DC Comics regime, character equity, they would pay them royalties. But the DC Comics contracts were all work made for hire. Those authors don't own any copyright interest.
But Gaiman acknowledged that Gaiman is not a What he did was not work for hire.
Correct. Correct. And well, we have here, as Your Honor points out, you have a contract that's put together, at least on one side of the contract, by Todd McFarlane, if someone has no idea what copyright law is. He's a blue-collar kid from Canada who now has a big-selling comic book. So he has a conversation with Neil, the only conversation they have back in 1992, when he says, I'll treat you as well as the big boys, you won't have to sign anything away. In Todd's mind, that's royalty rights. It's not copyright. And Neil is being paid, in fact, the demand letter from Neil's lawyer, which says he created these characters, he wasn't your employee, these are not works made for hire, which are certainly, to me, copyright demands. Then immediately turned.
Well, it's not copyright demand. He is pointing out he does have a copyright. Now the question is, what does that copyright entitle him to? Because as is so common, McFarlane is the publisher. All the money being earned by this copyright is coming in the first instance to McFarlane. So then the question is, how much of this is owed to Gaiman? And that's the sort of thing authors and publishers argue about a lot, without either of them supposing that there's any question about who owns the copyright. Because if he doesn't have the copyright, well, where is he?
Well, it would appear on its face and not disputed that when his lawyer writes that letter, she's asserting copyright rights.
Yes, but McFarlane is not denying copyright rights.
Well, McFarlane is never asked.
In fact, when McFarlane talks about swapping, what did he want to swap? He wanted to swap some
Miracle Man.
That. Well, when he talks in swapping terms, again, that's an acknowledgement that Gaiman has. You know, something, he has something swappable. The only thing he could have to swap would be a copyright.
Or a royalty right, which was under Todd's understanding.
But there's no
DC Comics version.
I mean, yeah, that could be, but there isn't anything in this that I've seen in the correspondence that suggests that you're talking about, and again, this is why doesn't it make sense for this to be a jury issue? Let the jury figure out whether they're talking about copyright or talking about contract. It's certainly not. I don't see how you can argue that it's clear.
I think
that McFarlane is denying a copyright.
What is clear is that there was a dispute and there were things.
But we don't know whether the dispute was about copyright ownership or about contractual rights.
Well. The
fact that suppose I copyright a book, and the publisher says he'll pay me 10% of the sales value of the book. Okay, so I have a copyright, and we have a contract, and we can have all sorts of arguments, disagreements over the contract without any challenge to the copyright. Now, what the jury thought was that with all his years of haggling. That there wasn't any reason for Gaiman to think that his copyrights were endangered. He just thought they were having an argument over what exactly his compensation is for the copyright license.
Well, that may be what the jury concluded, but there are comic books, Your Honor, that don't simply have the generic copyright notice. They have all characters are copyrighted Todd McFarlane Productions. Those are in evidence. At some point along the way, there's an inquiry notice going on. It should have
not
kept Mr. Gaiman
up. No, because this is perfectly standard notice on a compilation, which is it's the publisher's notice, and that's it, and none of the contributors. Because, look, as I say, you're certainly not going to say, are you, that McFarlane is claiming that he owns the copyright of the people who wrote the letters that are published in there.
No, only of the Spawn story.
No, he copyrighted the magazine.
He's asserting a copyright interest in Spawn. Let me just
talk about these other things. Now, So your argument about, say, Cagliostro, Count Cagliostro, whoever he is, is that he's too, you know, it's too thin. He's too kind of standard, wise wino, or whatever you call him.
Sort of an Obi-Wan Kenobi type.
Right.
A stock
okay.
figure.
And but here's the problem I have with that. Are you really saying that it's one thing to say that Gaiman can't copyright a wise wino, that's too standardized, you know, Senna Fair type of thing. But are you saying that you can actually use the name Cagliostro on such a character?
Yes, you can't copyright the
name. Well, that I don't think is right. I think the name is critical. I mean, suppose someone said, you know, remember Tonto and Lone Ranger? Suppose someone said Tonto is just a kind of standard sidekick type guy. There really isn't anything that original in him. He's like Sancho Panza or something. But it wouldn't follow that someone could use the name Tonto on an Indian, you know, Indian sidekick, and not be a copyright infringer.
I think,
but that's your claim, isn't it?
No, I think after a certain point, if that character becomes sufficiently delineated, then it would be misleading. It would be more of a trademark claim, as opposed to a copyright claim. If the character itself is simply a stock figure, or in the medieval Spawn case, is an unnamed character.
But once he's named, doesn't that give him enough character, enough individuality to be copyrightable?
No.
Do you have any examples of that where someone has appropriated not just a stock figure but the name of the stock figure?
Well, I think the Sam Spade case with Judge Leonard Hand, or whether there was a copyright, whether Dashiell Hammett had the copyright in the character Sam Spade, who went by the same name and was put into a radio show. I mean, that would be one example. I have my red light on.
I will give you a chance to rebut. But let me ask
sure.
you just one additional question. What is the accounting going on, or is it suspended because of the?
No, the accounting has. The accounting is moving very slowly, but the accounting is going on.
It's going on, but it's not near completion, or it's not.
I don't know, Jeff. We don't know what's going on with the accounting. It's with a Los Angeles accountant.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Kahn. Mr. Levin?
May it please the court, I'm Kenneth F. Levin with Jeff Simmons. We represent Mr. Gaiman and his company. Going to the second colloquy, I'd like to make two clarifying points. The comic book Spawn 9 was conceded by defendants to be a joint work of Gaiman and McFarlane for Section 101 Copyright Act purposes. That's the reason whether there was a copyright interest in that issue did not go to the jury. It was admitted in the answer. The same is true with regard to Angela issues 1, 2, and 3 and the Angela character. Those don't go to the jury because it was conceded that they were joint works and that he had a copyright interest but for the statute of limitations argument, but it had vested under the Act when they co-created it. So.
Well, they weren't admitted just for the purpose of the copyright, or just for the purpose of the statute of limitations. They were admitted generally, conceded generally, that they had a copyright interest in the client.
Yes, Your Honor, there's they actually allege it in their counterclaim as well as admitting it in paragraph 65 of ours. There's a...
That was just my point. It wasn't just the admission made for the purpose of deciding the...
It was not an issue to a case, and the reason I bring that up is because their argument, they actually make some new sort of finely parsed arguments about Cagliostro and medieval Spawn.
So in other words, I shouldn't be sitting here worrying about whether the copyright notice in the second Angela issue should have raised alarm bells, given that the Angela miniseries was Mr. Gaiman's creation?
If I understand your question, Your Honor, I think they fairly then did argue that although the copyright had existed and vested with Mr. Gaiman and Mr. McFarland, that somehow Mr. Gaiman had not discerned that Mr. McFarland at some point was attempting to usurp it. There's a reverse argument here, which is that Mr. McFarland couldn't do that, that he had waited too long to do it. But nonetheless, it went to the jury under that question. Yes, he had a copyright in Spawn 9. He had a copyright in Angela 1, 2, and 3. And he had a copyright in the Angela character, which is important because one of their arguments is you cannot copyright characters at all, which we think is plainly wrong under law. So they do make the argument to the jury, this statute of limitations argument, and one of the things they point to are these notices. And
why was there a jury in the case? Because weren't you just seeking an injunction and accounting?
No, Your Honor, the case went to the jury on both the questions of whether there were contracts, and if so, whether they were breached, and what the contract damages might have been.
I understand there'd be a jury on the contract claims. I just wondered why there was a jury on the copyright.
Well, I believe it's Horn from Your Honor, but there's several decisions that say that unless they're undisputed facts, the question of accrual is a fact question appropriate for the jury. And that's
right. I think it's an appropriate question, but the question is, you ordinarily, if you just brought a suit for an injunction and there was a statute of limitations defense, there wouldn't be a jury trial on the statute of limitations because it would be just an equitable suit.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I think I misapprehended the question. There was a request for damages initially for the copyright.
I see. So there was a request.
And the stipulation occurred in the middle of the case.
I see. Okay.
The question of medieval Spawn and Cogliostro not rising sufficiently to being characters, that they are somehow Steen's affair, we believe is simply not supportable. It's not supportable in so many ways. These are real characters. They are
did Cogliostro only appear in was it 14?
9, Your Honor. Well, initially in 9, which is the one Gaiman wrote.
I meant page 14 of 9. I think that's what I meant. Actually, the pages aren't numbered, so I don't know what I'm talking about. But I just saw one.
Coakley.
I just saw one sort of page or two about him.
It is a minor appearance in time.
These are Judge Posner's personal comics, too.
We can get them autographed, I think.
No, they have exhibit numbers. Exhibit 14 is that's what I meant,
yes,
by
sir.
14. So yes, he has only a brief appearance there.
Yes, but the law doesn't care, respectfully. What matters is this is a character that's created, and the law, particularly the Ninth Circuit, is very clear that the easiest characters to identify, to recognize, are the comic or cartoon characters, because they are not like Sam Spade, just words, or a generic wisecracking guy, but we see them. We know Mickey Mouse. We can see Mickey Mouse up on the screen. We know Mickey Mouse. Doesn't mean you get a copyright interest in all animated mice, but we know that one. Cogliostro ends up, among other things, appearing as the narrator with his wonderful Richard Dysart bass voice in every single episode of the HBO television show. So the marketplace recognizes Cogliostro. It was on HBO for 2 seasons, and you can buy the tapes.
Thank you.
Now you're going to have to buy the tapes.
So you're saying the visual image distinguishes him from any other wise wino.
Well, the visual image, the name, and the fact that the parties speak about him, Mr. McFarlane repeatedly speaks about him as the Cogliostro character. There is no confusion here. There's no debate about whether or not we are talking about Cogliostro. The stipulation says Gaiman's script for Spawn 9 included three characters that had never appeared in a prior issue of Spawn, one of them Count Nicholas Cogliostro. The Angelo and Cogliostro characters were not based upon any pre-existing comic book characters. That was a party stipulation and was read to the jury. McFarlane admitted in testimony that all of these characters became toys, so the marketplace sees Cogliostro and can identify him.
It became a toy, too?
That's what he testifies to. He testifies all three became a toy. I can't... Uh, 2-263 is the record site. Mr. McFarlane acknowledges all three been toys. In fact, Mr. McFarlane published a book, or his company published a book. It was sort of the Spawn mythos or ethos, or, you know, like you would on a baseball team. And he testifies and notes that in the 12, 13 years of Spawn stories and books and so forth, there have been 15 major characters, and three of them are Angela, Medieval Spawn, and Cogliostro. So he identifies Cogliostro as one of the 15 major characters in the Spawn series. I do agree that you could create a different Wino character if that's what it was, but Cogliostro was much more than that, and Gaiman, who actually was the first one to draw him as well with these sketches. The fact that it's a little, arguably, piece of the puzzle under the Erickson decision, which we think is controlling the Seventh Circuit's decision, says it doesn't matter. If you're a joint contributor to a work and you are given joint copyright status, then you have an undivided interest in everything in there. To do it otherwise, which is what they suggest, that would create chaos. Every time you had a movie and then suddenly you have a toy, or a song would spin out, they would argue about, well, who contributed what to this? Did the composer do the song? Did the writer not? You can't have that and have market order. And that's exactly what Erickson says in Trinity is not the law. The quote, I believe, is something like, yes, it's true that in certain instances, somebody who makes a small contribution can have a very great benefit in that particular aspect. But you either are or you are not a joint copyright owner. And as to that, that was a stipulated fact.
When Mr. Gaiman was negotiating with Mr. McFarlane, and Mr. McFarlane's offers were so much lower than would be expected for a joint copyright owner, shouldn't that have put him on notice that his copyright interests weren't being recognized?
I think not, Your Honor, and it certainly didn't. If Your Honor, for example, looks at the testimony of Mr. Martyr, who's actually doing the negotiation, and looks at the exhibits 39 to 45, Mr. Martyr is signing Gaiman memo saying, I'm sorry this has taken so long, he's hard to get to, you know, I apologize. There's no suggestion. It's not, we're not going to get this done. And what Gaiman is looking for is a writing because he's heard McFarlane may sell the company. And his concern is, well, Todd said, trust me, I didn't give up my rights, but if Todd sells the company, it'd be nice to have something in the files that says, here's what you get when there's a movie, here's what you get when there's a television show. And that's the purpose of the writing. And what happens when the February 97 quote offer comes in, which Mr. Martyr says in testimony, I know that this is, you know, I know this wasn't what DC was, but this is what Todd told me to do.
You know, I may have missed this, or maybe I'm just not remembering, but well, does the record tell us how much Mr. Gaiman had made up to the point of the suit?
It says inferentially, I mean, you can add it up, he made about $100,000 on Spawn 9, which he testified was about what he would have gotten from DC for a book that sold that much. His book sold well over a million copies and made well over $1 million for Mr. McFarlane Wholesale. He'd received, I believe, some 20-something thousand for toys up to that point. And there were other toys which Mr. McFarlane was selling him. And Mr. McFarlane essentially said, look, until you get this writing done, I'm not going to pay you any more money. And that's Mr. Gaiman's frustration, was finally to have his lawyer send this letter. And the response to that letter, we think, is dispositive, because the response to the letter from Ms. Cook is not, wait a minute, are you claiming I've got a copyright interest? We dispute that, or we're not claiming that coverage. The response is, sorry, it's taken too long, let's meet immediately. That letter is in April 5th, 6th, 7th, something like that. They're meeting April 23rd, McFarlane and Gaiman in California, where Martyr has asked Gaiman to be the keynote speaker. So the discussions are always very friendly between Martyr and Gaiman. And Gaiman asks his lawyer to write essentially a collection lawyer, or could you goose him a long letter? And she does, and sends the DC contract. Says, by the way, here's the DC contract. Let's remember what you're supposed to be paying him against with respect to this. Did I answer that? I just have a few seconds. This was a jury decision that led to this injunction. We believe the applicable standard that they suggest just isn't correct. The jury had ample evidence. Judge Shabazz's decision of January 9th, which is the same day as the second amended judgment that has the final injunction that is appealed from, goes through a litany of all the reasons why the jury probably shouldn't have, but certainly need not have, found that Gaiman should have been put on inquiry notice. My time's up. Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Levin. Mr. Kahn, your time expired, but we'll give you a couple of minutes.
A couple of points, Your Honor. In answer to your question, Judge Rovner, was a little bit over $200,000 that Mr. Gaiman received. The focus on Cagliostro and Medieval Spawn is not what they look like in the HBO video that Mr. McFarlane produced, or what they look like in the live-action motion picture. It's what they were in Issue 9. Because that's the only thing that Mr. Gaiman...
But he's saying in Issue 9 there's a distinctive physical appearance as well as a name, and that individuates it and distinguishes it from other stock characters, other wise wines.
Two answers to that, Your Honor. Number one, and this is actually the actual case law, I'm unaware of any case involving character copyrights that's ever involved anything other than a major character. Rocky Balboa,
yeah,
and Scott Zillis, Mickey.
But if he got a toy made out of him, it makes it pretty major, doesn't
if,
it?
If we now want to say, is this, if you want to reach the point to say, as Medieval Spawn appears in issue, the unnamed Spawn character appears in Issue 9 from the Middle Ages, is actually separately copyrightable, independently copyrightable, then under your Erickson case, you need to then look at, for that character, what did each party contribute? Mr. McFarlane contributed the visual, Mr. Gaiman contributed an idea, which was your main character back in the Middle Ages.
No, but that's not right. That's not right. No.
Why isn't that?
No,
I don't understand why that's not right.
Because when you have a joint copyright, you don't divide it up and ask whether each contributor made a copyrightable contribution. That's wrong.
No, Your Honor.
You have a bunch of people get together and they decide we're going to write a novel, and you know it's going to be our joint ownership. It's going to be our joint work. And yet it turns out one of the people just gave the idea for the novel. So he couldn't copyright that separately, but in other words, you can decompose a copyrightable work into non-copyrightable elements, each contributed by a separate person, and it's still a copyrightable work, and they're the joint owners.
Well, Under the character copyright cases, you have to analyze the characters independently. If you're claiming the character exists outside of the work.
No, this is not right. Look, your Sam Spade case, now, my recollection of that is that what was at issue was that Sam Spade wanted to use his, I don't know, Sam Spade, Dashiell Hammett wanted to use Sam Spade again in his own work. And it was, the publisher who was trying to prevent him from using his own character. Wasn't that the case?
Yeah, you know, Your Honor, that may be right. I haven't read that case since I wrote the opening brief. I remember it was a fight over whether the Sam Spade character
right.
could be independently copyrighted outside of the context of whatever the worker was that it appeared.
But now, isn't it implicit in your argument that I could, well, I'm not allowed to go into business, but if I resigned, I could make a Cagliostro toy, right?
Yes.
It's not copyrightable.
Well, this is the more subtle point, which is that minor characters become independently copyrightable. And this is really more of a legal standard. If they can exist outside of the universe in which they're created. So can Cagliostro exist outside of the Spawn universe? Can Jimmy Olsen exists outside of the Superman universe, and the answer is yes.
First you said it's not copyrightable, then you say you're going to sue me if I try to manufacture it.
No, I just said you would have to ask that question.
Well, what do you have to ask that question? If it's not copyrightable, why can't I make it?
Well,
in the public domain, right?
If it isn't copyrightable, Your Honor.
You said it was. Your position is it's not copyrightable.
My position as of Spawn Issue 9 is it's not separately copyrightable.
Did McFarlane license Cagliostro to whoever made the toy?
Yes.
How did he do that? He didn't have any rights in it. How could he license it?
He could license it as
part
of the Spawn universe.
How could he license something that's not copyrightable?
You can license
Spawn universe. Completely. What's the party? I don't understand you. I mean, that doesn't make any sense. This fellow Gaiman does Cagliostro, you say it's not copyrightable. Maybe you're right. Now you say he did it, but McFarlane somehow owns the copyright on this uncopyrightable thing and can license it.
I'm saying eventually. I don't know how many more issues it took. 50 issues, 40 issues. In the first Superman, Jimmy Olsen is not copyrightable, but maybe by issue 50, he's now sufficiently delineated that he's actually a separate character. But for the purposes of this court, you just look at the script and at the comic book for issue 9 and ask yourself, this unnamed Spawn from the Middle Ages, is he copyrightable? Is he separately copyrightable as of the end of issue 9? And if the answer is yes, that leads you to one result. I submit that if this is a legal question, if you look at the cases,
well,
and you look at what's there.
But as long as I don't... All right, so you have this Cagliostro character. You embroider it over 50 issues or something, and you license it. But as long as I just use the original Cagliostro in issue 9, which you say is in the public domain, surely I can make a toy out of that because it's in the public domain.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, but I think by the time it gets to the HBO animated series, it isn't anymore. As Ken pointed out, it began as just a minor character with two appearances in issue 9, but by the HBO special, the character's changed. It's become more of a Moses-like figure, and it becomes the narrator. And so this is just a slice in time, issue 9. And as I leave, I would just encourage the court to read the copyright notices on page 17 and 18 of our brief, Your Honor, which specify specific characters as opposed to a collective word copyright.
Okay, well, thank you very, very much, Mr. Kahn and Mr. Levin, for a very interesting argument. And we're now going to take a short recess.